All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, world. Welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, United States Army, 1967 to 1971, 100 years ago, it seems like. Anyway, I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot. Served in Vietnam in 1969 with 195th Assault Helicopter Company and made it back alive. There's a great story right there, I think, sometimes. I want to welcome you to our program today. We're going to be talking with two guests that I'm really excited to have on the program. Coming up in just a moment, it's going to be Command Sergeant Major Donald Mac McAllister. And he is representing, he's a community outreach director for an organization called the Independence Fund. And this is a great organization, and I can't wait to talk to him about this. And I'll hold off what they do exactly until I bring him on. But I think it's going to be great. In the second half of the program, we're going to be talking with a gentleman. His name is Captain Art Holst. And Art Holst is a 95-year-old veteran of World War II. He was with Patton's Third Army after the Battle of the Bulge. And after that, he was an NFL umpire and referee, so I don't know which was more dangerous, probably. And his current assignment is that he's a spokesman then to help out raising funds for the local Fisher House. And so Kate Melcher is also going to be here. She's the executive director of Fisher House. And so she and Art are going to be on in the second half of the program. So stay tuned for all of those things that are going to happen coming up shortly. A couple of events that I did want to point out to you that are going to be coming up shortly is the first one is the, as soon as I can find it, where did it go? There it is Camp Liberty is having, Camp Liberty is a wilderness camp for, that has been set up for veterans, and it's here in the local Ann Arbor area. It's out west of Manchester, Michigan, and they've got an open house coming up on July 29th. And so it's going to be everybody's invited. How's that one? And to find out more information about the Camp Liberty Open House, you can go to their website, which is camp-liberty.org. It's camp-liberty.org. And you can find out all the information that you need for their open house. It is on July 29th. And I think it sounds like it's going to be really a fun day. Lots of activities, lots of sports activities. There's going to be bow and arrows, things going on. There's fishing and a lot of other different things that they're going to be providing for you. So I strongly encourage you to go to their website. That's camp-liberty.org. And the other thing, of course, that's coming up around Michigan again is to make sure that your calendar on Labor Day weekend has got the Yankee Air Museum's Thunder Over Michigan. We'll be coming to here again with the Thunderbirds and just about every different kind of aircraft you can imagine. It's going to be running for almost 4 days this year, so that's even better. And you can find more information about that by going to YankeeAirMuseum.org. That's YankeeAirMuseum.org, and that's over Labor Day weekend. I think it's a great event. And there's one other one, but I can't seem to find the paper, that there's a job fair going to be held at Washtenaw Community College that is going to be coming up on the 24th, I believe it is, a week from Monday. And it's in the afternoon. It's from 3:30 to 5:30, I believe it is. And it's at the Morris Lawrence Building, and there's all kinds of companies there that are looking to hire veterans. So make sure that you head over to Washtenaw Community College. You can find the information on their site under their upcoming events, and I'm going to try and get it out onto our website for you, too. You know, you're listening to Veterans Radio, and you can find more information about us at our website, veteransradio.net. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and all those other social media forums, and we do not deal in fake news. So make sure that you listen to what we're talking about and pay attention to us. Okay, coming up is our first guest for today's program, and here it is right now. So joining me on the line is retired Command Sergeant Major Donald Mac McAllister. He's going to tell us all about this independent fund. He was in the military for a number of years. I think he did 5 tours, and I'm sure he'll correct me on this, but there was at least 2 in Iraq, 3 in Afghanistan, had his own Humvee blown up and blown out from under him, so we'll let him tell that story. Mac, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me, Dale.
Well, thank you very much for your service, of course, and thank you for this organization, it sounds like, that you've gotten yourself involved with. Let's talk about your experience first, and then we'll talk about the Independence Fund. How's that?
Okay.
All right. So you sound very young. I'm not trying to insult you, but you sound rather young for a command sergeant major. How long were you in the service?
For almost 25 years.
Okay. Well, you aged well. At least your voice did.
Yes, sir. I'm 44 now, so.
Okay. So tell me about your service. Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from southeast Louisiana. It's a little town called Hammond, Louisiana. There's another small town right next to it called Ponchatoula. That's where I went to high school and all, and joined the Army in 1992 and left, and only been back on leave and to visit family.
Yeah, I think all of us who've ever been in the service can relate to that. My only experience with Louisiana was I went to Fort Polk for basic.
Oh, that wasn't a good experience then.
See, I didn't say that. This,
yeah,
it was interesting. Let's put it that way. So I am a graduate of Tigerland, but
okay.
All right. So you joined the Army in the 90s, and off you went. So what happened next?
Well, I actually, my first duty assignment, I was in the Honor Guard in up in D.C. And then I was in the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii, and then reenlisted and went to the 82nd Airborne Division. And when I got to the 82nd Airborne, I got there in around August of 2002.
Oh, okay.
Before I knew it, I was on my way to Iraq for the initial push in Iraq, and we actually left in March of 2003, and that was my first combat deployment. I was a weapons squad leader at the time.
Okay.
So we deployed, I was a senior staff sergeant, a weapons squad leader, and about 3 months into the deployment, the sergeant first class list came out, and I made it, so I became a platoon sergeant while I was deployed. And about 10 months into the deployment, I was seriously wounded. Two of my soldiers were as well, and my interpreter was killed. We were attacked by, you know, it was an IED. Back then, they were roadside bombs, so we didn't have any, you know, up-armored Humvees or anything. So it was, from what they tell me, it was 5.155 rounds buried underneath the asphalt that hit my truck.
Wow.
Immediately following the blast, they did back then what we called, you know, a coordinated attack on us. So they had like a van that did a drive by. So it was a coordinated, you know, attack that was actually, you know, we were targeted because it was our platoon area. And anyway, from there, got evacuated, went to the cache there in Baghdad, got emergency surgery, and then was sent to Germany, and then was sent to Walter Reed for a couple months, and then finally was able to let him get me back to Fort Bragg, and I fought to heal back up, and then deployed again in December of 2004, Iraq, when the big surge was going on for the first elections over there.
Mm-hmm.
Deployed to Baghdad, was there for 2 months, and then deployed up to Mosul. We actually got to Mosul actually January 1st of 2005, and it was a pretty hot area up there. Finished that deployment, came back, and then I was a observer controller for about a year and a half. It was kind of, I never really had time to heal up, so that was kind of my heal up job. And then I made the master sergeant list, and then was able to get back into the 82nd and deployed as a first sergeant to Afghanistan in 2007-08, and then deployed again in 9-10, and then I deployed in 13-14 as a sergeant major.
Wow. I'm always constantly amazed at you men and women that have done these multiple deployments. How did you ever do that? I mean, just psychologically and physically.
Well, physically, it really took a toll on me. As you get old, especially with all the gear and everything we carry now, but you know, I mean, it's, you know, it is once you're in and it's your life and it's your, you know, as you become a leader, it's your soldiers, you know, it's like everything that you do daily, you know, affects them, you know, it's all about life and death. And, you know, if the guys with the experience are getting out, you know, right after their combat's over and stuff like that, and then where's all the experience go? And so, you know, the hardest thing for anybody, I think, is you know, it's hard on their families.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially for a guy like me, you know, I had three little girls when I was wounded, and they didn't understand why their dad was deploying again, you know, after visiting me and Walter Reed and stuff like that. Now that they're older, they understand, but, you know, when they're young, they don't understand why, you know, daddy or mommy's leaving again.
Was your wife in the service as well?
No, sir.
Oh, okay.
The
children with a mom and dad that are deploying, I think, even as you just mentioned, makes it even more confusing, I would think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's really hard on them. Like, I will tell you, my middle daughter Cassandra, she's in college right now, and she, she's in her junior year, but her freshman year of college, she had to write a paper, and she wrote one about when I was wounded and in Iraq the first time and all, and it amazed me at how much detail was in it and how much she remembered. She was only, you know, what, 7, 8 years old when I was wounded. So it sticks with them. And, you know, but your family, if you have that good support system there and, you know, they really, you know, they respect what you're doing and why you're doing it. And, you know, as the kids get older, they really understand, but it's still hard on them. And, you know, I think they take that deep breath of fresh air whenever they hear the retire word, you know.
I'm sure that they do. We are talking with retired Command Sergeant Major Don, better known as Mac McAllister. Six tours, it's everywhere, all over the, you know, all over the Middle East, it seems like. And so at the end of 25 years, decided that it was time to get out, huh?
Yes, sir. I had to get a cervical fusion on my neck, and it was, you know, I couldn't jump out of planes anymore. And then my time was up. You know, I was a battalion command sergeant major, and it was like I could take a desk job, you know, somewhere and go back to being operations. And, you know, I told myself once I got, you know, as an infantryman, once you reach that shelf life, it's time to call it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll continue to hurt yourself. And so it was a hard decision, but I made the decision to get out. And I knew that the only thing I knew that I wanted to do when I decided to retire was, you know, work somewhere to where I could give back to the guys that have been under me and been with me and have given so much, you know. So that's and fortunately enough, I was able to, you know, get hired by the Independence Fund, and it's been an amazing ride.
Well, that's a good transition segue, as they say. Let's go and let's talk a little bit about the Independence Fund, because I found it really just incredible to me.
Yes, sir. So the Independence Fund, and I'll actually tell you the way I actually learned about them was a few years ago. One of my soldiers, Mike Verardo, he was wounded when we were in Afghanistan in 2010, and he lost his part of his leg, his arm was pretty much blown off. He was, you know, wounded really bad. And, after going through a lot of surgeries and everything else and, you know, being in a wheelchair while he's still trying to figure out how to get a prosthetic and everything, the Independence Fund actually helped him with a tracked wheelchair. And, you know, I had never heard of him. And then I saw what they had done for him and, you know, what that chair was doing and how it just kind of changed his life. And I knew then, you know, that was an amazing organization. Now, if you would have asked me back in 2012 when I found that, if I'd ever been working with them, I'd have never guessed I would. But anyway, you know, so as I'm, you know, in my transition for retirement, Mike's wife actually had kind of mentioned me to, you know, some of the board members and all for the fund. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to send my resume, and then they flew me out to talk to them. And, you know, they offered me the job as the community outreach director because, you know, I speak the language and, you know, it's all about you know, we work, everything's off of donations, but it's about, for me, getting the word out there so the guys know where they can come to get help.
I totally agree with you. I'm just going to read your little mission statement that you've got on your website. By the way, folks,
yes, sir.
The website is independencefund.org, and I want to, while I read this, I want you to think about how you're going to describe these wheelchairs that they have. So it says the Independent Fund's mission is to empower our severely wounded veterans and their caregivers to take control of their lives. We provide the resources and tools that enable veterans to work through their physical, mental, and emotional wounds and regain their independence. And one of the things that they use are these incredible tracked, what do they call them?
They're track chairs is what they
track
call them,
chairs,
actually.
Okay.
So yes, sir.
Can you describe them to our listeners?
Yeah, so we actually, the track chairs, there are three different types that we provide. There's the actual Action Track chair. There's two companies made through Action Track. There's the Action Track chair and then the Action Track standard. And then we have another track chair company called Track Fab. The Action Track, it has, you know, they have tracks kind of like if you look at like a, you know, a little bobcat bulldozer or something like that. The tracks are kind of along those lines. It's made for all terrain. The thing about them, what's amazing about all these chairs is the veteran, you know, if they love to hunt, fish, they love to be outdoors or anything, they can get out there, go through the snow, go through the mud, go through the sand, throw their kids on their lap, get out and do things that they can never do in a wheelchair. What's amazing about the track standard is the track standard actually stands up. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I saw a picture of one of those, it's another amazing invention that somebody has come with that allows these men and women to actually stand up and the track moves around their wherever they want them to go, right?
Yes, sir. So if they're, you know, if they're paraplegic or, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, for once they can get in this chair and stand up, and then guys like us have to look up at them, you know, which is pretty awesome.
I would think.
And, you know, they move around just like anything else. The Track Fab is a track chair like the Action Track, but it's more designed for like guys that just like to get outdoors but not really out in the woods and stuff like that. So, you know, if they want to get around the, you know, the park or whatever, it's great. We also have these chairs that are they're Freedom 6x6s. They have like six little knobby tires on them, and you know, the veterans can get around sand, mud, and everything with those. And we also provide what we call a Zoom chair. The Zoom chair has four wheels, and they're kind of like, it kind of looks like a BMX tire, but bigger.
Oh, okay.
And these Zoom chairs will actually go about 12 miles an hour. I can tell you real fast about, it was last month, I was there I delivered one to a retired Command Sergeant Major here in North Carolina that did, he did 30 years in the military, 17 years as a police officer. He wanted a wheelchair. He wanted something to get around and not a scooter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the Zoom chair and thought it looked cool. And, you know, he was acting like the old tough Sergeant Major. And then, he sat in that Zoom chair and he had a smile from ear to ear and was just zooming around the neighborhood. And, you know, I mean, these things, like, they literally, like, you can see it and immediately feel how much it just changes, you know, what these guys are going through. Like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the gloves are off and they can go do stuff that, you know, they never would have imagined possible. And, you know, we provide all this through donations. And these chairs, you know, they run anywhere from $16,000 to $18,000 a piece.
That's what I was doing. I'm looking at the website right now at all the different types of these. They're off-road trikes, and there's these things, the other things that you were talking about. And, you know, I think the idea of these men and women just being able to get around without any assistance, you know, from another person. I think the caregivers would love these things just as much as the veteran does.
Well, that's what I was actually about to say, that it, you know, Yeah, we provide the veteran, you know, the independence, but it also gives that caregiver, you know, it takes a load off of their chest and, you know, kind of gives them a breather. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing. And, you know, myself being in as long as I have and being on so many combat deployments, a lot of my soldiers have been, you know, either under my command or in other units and everything, or amputees and stuff like that. And to see these guys get this help that just, like, oh, you know, just as soon as they get in the chair, it just changes their outlook on things. It's just amazing. Like, and it's not only the chairs that we also do a lot for the caregivers. We do a lot mainly for respite, you know, get them out there, get them away.
Yeah, get them away from them.
Yes, sir. We also have a wellness program. Every month we send about two veterans up to the Eisenhower Center in Michigan.
Just down the road from our station right here.
Yes, sir, right there. It's outside of Ann Arbor.
Yep.
Well, actually, it's in Ann Arbor, but the farm that they go out to is out towards Chelsea, Michigan.
Correct, yes.
But it's an amazing, you know, program. We're able to get a couple veterans a month out there with some first responders and NFL players and get them out there for 30 days and just kind of give them a new lease on, you know, new outlook and, you know, a fresh start, I guess you could kind of say.
I wasn't even aware that you were affiliated with the Eisenhower Center. So I think this is a great synergistic thing that we're talking about here with the idea.
Yes, sir.
Where is the Independence Fund? Where are they headquartered?
Charlotte, North Carolina, sir.
Okay. And how do people donate to it or help out?
If you go to the website, there's a donate tab. Once you click on the donate tab, you can mail in donations, you know, checks. You can go online and do a recurring donation, or you can do a one-time donation online, but it's all right there on the website.
Okay.
And it's the website's pretty intuitive, so you just click on the donations and it'll explain to you, you know, how to do each one.
I'm just going across the little dashboard on the top of your website here, and it's got the home.
Yes, sir.
It's got about what the programs are. If you are a veteran, you also can go to their website and apply for assistance. You know,
yes, sir.
Luckily, everything works on me, and I don't have to worry about it. But the idea is, if I were paralyzed, this would be a great opportunity for me to get up and to start feeling better about myself, and to give me some ability to get out of the house and to just do things. It's a little normalization to our lives.
So yes, sir. And I want to point out too that you know, we say severely wounded, but it's also, you know, injured or ill, because you know as well as I do, a lot of veterans are being diagnosed now with ALS and mm-hmm. certain things like that. So we will not turn anybody away. Now, you know, they have to meet our criteria for a chair. Obviously, they need to mm-hmm. be, you know, wheelchair, but. You know, we're any veteran, any war, doesn't matter. If they need help, we're going to help them.
Well, I think this is a great thing, Mac, and I appreciate you coming on the program and telling us all about the Independence Fund. I think it's something that we're definitely going to support and promote as much as we can. Could you go just again, how much one of these chairs might cost?
Yes, sir. So the regular action track chair is about $16,000.
Okay.
The track standard is around 18, and the track fab's right in the middle, you know, in between 16,000 and 17,000. There are the Zoom chairs are around 12,000. So they're not cheap. And on average, we have been providing about 30 a month.
30? That's great.
Yes, sir. Now, and right now we have a list that are approved. And the thing about the chairs is when a veteran gets approved for the chair, like, the chair is not built until we approve the veteran. And then the veteran can actually get it customized, what color they want it. They can get five accessories, so a gun rack, a snow plow, a trailer hitch,
you know, a fishing pole rack,
you all these things.
You don't just get a drink holder.
No, sir. You get, we're about to give one to a Marine Corps sniper that was wounded on his third deployment. I talked to him last week, mm-hmm. and he's so excited about getting the track standard because he was a sniper. and he wants to get back out there with his sniper rifle and, you know, do the things that he used to do. And I mean, he's so psyched about it. And like I tell you, it's just, you know, for those guys to be able to get out and just do what they did before, and you know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, you think about it, you haven't been able to walk, or you're walking with a prosthetic, or you're paralyzed, and you know, you have your kids and your dogs, and next thing you know, you can get out in the yard with your kids on your lap. You know, like we gave a chair to a guy that he told me for the first time since he was wounded, he was able to feed his horses, which was amazing.
I think it's great. Thank you very much, Mac. We got to go. You can hear the music coming up there. So
yes, sir.
It's the independencefund.org. And thank you very much.
Sir.
Give us a call back when you have more information. I think it's going to be something that we can help you out with.
Yes, sir. I really appreciate it, sir.
Okay. Thank you. We'll be right back after the news. We are back here on Veterans Radio, and everybody should have been in the studio right now, because our guest actually is, it's kind of interesting. It's a 95-year-old veteran, and he's singing Caissons Goes Rolling Along here as we're getting ready for to this portion of the program. Joining me in the studio right now is Kate Melcher, and Kate is the executive director for Fisher House of Michigan. Hi, Kate.
Hi. It's great to be back. Thank you.
It's good to have you back. This is old home week. You know, it's kind of interesting. We talked to the gentleman, Mac McAllister from the Independence Fund, and he's connected with the Eisenhower Center, which is here in Ann Arbor as well. And now, of course, we have the Fisher House. So we're kind of going all around the world, and it all comes home, which I think is kind of fun. So I asked Kate to come here to introduce our guest for today's program, because he has now become a spokesman for the Fisher House of Michigan. So, Kate, I'm going to turn it over to you for a second, and then we'll ask him a lot of questions.
Yes, sir. One of my favorite things about my job is that I come into contact with so many different veterans from all different eras. And one of my favorite people that I've gotten to meet is a gentleman by the name of Art Holst. And as you mentioned, he's a 95-year-old veteran. He served in World War II in the European theater. He was a captain in Patton's Third Army. And since then, he's been pretty busy. He likes to call himself an average person who had some good luck throughout his life. But he served as an NFL official. He's been a professional speaker for management and sales for years. And not only does he get to tell his stories to his 28 great-grandchildren, but he also tells his stories at our annual events. And, you know, we're just absolutely blessed to have him as part of the Fisher House Michigan team.
Well, I totally agree. So, Art, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you, Kate, that feel kind of like the guy that stuck his head up out of the grave on Judgment Day, and he looked at the epitaph on the tombstone. He said, either somebody's a big liar or I'm in the wrong hole, but thank you very much.
Yes, all right. Well, anyway, Art, thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program. And I wanted to, I was in my research about you, in addition to your service during World War II, which you've got a great souvenir of that we'll talk about in just a second. So what were you doing prior to going into the service? Were you in college, or did you?
Yes, I was in college in Galesburg, Illinois, where I grew up. And none of my family actually had been to college, and my mother insisted that I go and took me down and said to the registrar, this man doesn't have any money, this young man doesn't have any money, got to go to college, how's he going to do it? And an hour later, I walked out of there and enrolled, and I started my career as a janitor and dishwasher for 4 years.
But, where did you go to school?
Knox College.
Oh, okay.
Presbyterian School in Galesburg, Illinois, founded in the 1830s. Good school, and I probably couldn't get in it now, because I don't think my IQ and intelligence level is that high. But at that time, they were desperate, and I don't say this out of humility, but they were desperate for kids, because it was the bottom of the Depression. Mm-hmm. I started school in 1939.
Okay.
So I got my degree there, and that's where I stumbled into ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, in the infantry. Mm-hmm. And signed up with my two buddies that I went in with, Leo Munson and Bob Kemp. We'd been buddies since junior high school. And we took ROTC because we're going to march and learn how to take a rifle apart. It didn't sound like a good thing. And then in 1941, on December 7th, I was in a bed recovering from pneumonia in the hospital in Galesburg, Illinois. And I listened to the Bear-Packer game. I was a great Bear fan, never knowing that someday I would work the Bears and the Packers on the field. But I was listening to that. They broke in to say that the Japanese had started a bomb Pearl Harbor, and it was a real major tragedy. And I didn't know what I was going to do after I graduated, but when I heard that broadcast, I knew that my future had already been decided for me, because I knew I was going to end up in the service. And so we went in the service. All of us in my class were actually inducted into the Army in March of 43, but we were able to finish college and went to basic training after that, and then on to OCS.
Okay, and so now when did you deploy overseas?
Well, I finished OCS in December of 1943 in Fort Benning, Georgia, at the Harmony Church area, the Benning School for Boys, we called it.
It hasn't changed much.
Kate knew that when she picked me up today. She was getting acquainted with my past, and she's less at Benning School for Boys. I said, that's it. And I graduated in 43. I was in OCS Class 312, and my two buddies that I went in with were at the same time, same place. Leo didn't make it, and he ended up as a corporal in the 80th Infantry Division. Bob was graduated as second lieutenant in the 95th or 96th Division. Bob was killed in Belgium, in the Hurtgen Forest, in November 1944. And about a week from that, Leo was hit through the leg with what we called a million-dollar wound.
Yes,
you couldn't get off the line over there. It wasn't tours of duty and then off. The only way to get off the line was to get killed, wounded, or captured. And, of course, poor Bob was killed. He was going to be a doctor, a wonderful young man. Mm-hmm. And Leo was a really good student. He got with a million-dollar wound, hit through the thigh, and it didn't ruin him for life. And Leo was out and out of the service, home and back out of the service, and lived to be long left, died a few years ago. So I was fortunate. I went to Texas to train troops and trained troops for a year. And then everybody had to go overseas, even if they pulled you out there, but you could not stay and train troops for more than a year. You had to go.
Okay.
And I went overseas in January of 1945. And was sent as a replacement for the Battle of the Bulge into a unit in General Patton's Third Army, and joined in the combat area early February, and then the war ended in May, and we went down through Frankfurt, Würzburg, Aschaffenburg, Nuremberg. I was in Nuremberg on my 22nd birthday.
Isn't it amazing what you accomplished in your 22 years old?
Yep, and finished the war about a mile from the Austrian border in May of 1945. And just quickly, one of the interesting things, I captured a German right at the end of the war, and he could speak English, and I was having to deal with my mission that I had, with deal with some German railroad workers, and the only words I could speak in German were Heiß Wasser, hot water, and Dankeschön, and thank you, and that didn't get you far.
No.
And he spoke good English. And I gave him the option. I never heard of doing this, but I gave him the option to go in a prison camp or becoming my interpreter. That's Dolmetscher in German. And he opted to do that. And I trusted him, and it was a good choice because our birthdays were within 2 months of each other. I make a long story short, I got him out of the service in July, and we ended up becoming lifelong friends. He died a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I saw him again in Munich, Germany 40 years later. So it was an interesting experience. I told Kate on the way out here, people talk about the infantry in foxholes, and I average it all the time. Did you have to live in foxhole or stay in a foxhole? I said, yeah, I did, in Georgia. I never was in a foxhole. I never was in a foxhole in Europe because General Patton said, we don't dig foxholes, they do.
I was just going to ask you if you had met General Patton.
No, never. I saw his car go by, but
that before too.
I never met him. But interestingly enough, he drove Eisenhower crazy because he'd show up at the front line. Shortly after I came, I wasn't there, present of course, but they were trying to cross. I think it was the Ruhr River.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking for a place to cross it. And he came into a battalion meeting, the officer of the battalion, totally unannounced. He'd get his driver and drive right up the front lines. And so he comes in with his driver, and everybody jumped to attention. He said, "Sit up, sit down. What's going on?" He showed him the map. "We're trying to figure out where to cross the Roar River. We got the engineers coming up." And he brought up, and he says, "Good." He left, got in his Jeep, told the driver he had a map, told the driver where to drive him. He went up to the front line, got out of the Jeep, went to the river, found the place where you could wade across, came back to the meeting and said, "I'll tell you where to go. You can cancel the engineers.
Just walk here."
So he was the hands-on type of commander. But I never met him. I knew his reputation. I can tell you one thing. I won't repeat it now, but when we got there as a replacement, we were given the copy of his speech that he made to the officers when the Third Army was formed in Normandy. And I read that thing, and I read the first paragraph. I'm not going to repeat the language, but
fairly,
I'm going to tell
fairly
you,
graphic, I'm sorry.
I read that thing, and I thought, what am I getting into?
That is true. That is true. We are talking with Art Holstier, who's now doing some work with the Fisher House of Michigan, and talking with him about his experiences during World War II. Fortunately, he came back okay. And when you did come back, well, let me back up a little bit. I've talked to so many veterans from World War II that were in Germany at the end. Did you have the unfortunate time period of going through concentration camps or seeing anything of
it? I did. The war ended on May 8th, and just 2-3 days after the war ended, I saw a Jeep from the 45th Division. I had to go back to the rear headquarters, which was in Munich. And I saw a Jeep there with the 45th Division. And I'd gotten married just before I went over. And one of my classmates and buddy, Bob Martens, who was an officer in the 45th, I knew he'd been hit a couple times, but I didn't know whether he was dead or still there or what. I stopped this Jeep, and the sergeant said, "What do you want, Lieutenant?" I said, "By chance, do you know Lieutenant Robert Martens?" And our division is 15,000 men. Mm. He said, "Yeah, he's a heavy weapons company commander." He said, "Been hit a couple times, but he's all right." I said, "Where are you guys?" He said, "We captured Dachau." So he gave me his field phone number, and I called him. He said, "Art, you got to come up and see this. You won't believe it." So it was right after the war, days after the war, I went up there. And I was there when the prisoners were still there that were not sick enough to be in the hospital but too sick to travel. Mm-hmm. And I saw the people with arms that big around, skin stretched over their yellow skin over their faces, eyes popping out. And so when I hear people say, I heard an interview one time on the radio, much like this, where the people being interviewed said the Holocaust was a hoax, I couldn't wait to call that producer and get on that show, which I did, because I was there and I saw this horror myself, and you could not believe that civilized people could do this to other people. And it's something that really affected my life. And I was never a hero. I got over there after the bulge, the casualties had dropped. I was in a unit in the infantry, but right behind the line troops. And I tell people that the only hero, I never knew a guy that thought he was a hero that lived. The heroes are the guys like my buddy Bob Kemp, who lied on, under crosses in the 24 cemeteries that there are across the world that are United States cemeteries.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that story with us, Art, and I didn't mean to blindside you with that. It's just something that I, as you just mentioned, there are people out there that don't, for whatever reason, don't actually believe that those things happened. And I think it's so important. That's one of the reasons we do this program, is to get the veterans to talk about what they have seen and what they have done. And, you know, a veteran to me and to you is, you know, we just signed a name on our list. We did our job and we came home. And I think it's about just ordinary people who have done extraordinary things in the service of their country. And well, in 1945, did that, and then you were done and you got out.
I didn't feel extraordinary at all. We did what we had to do. But I can say this, that my personal experience is that because of loud explosions damaged my hearing. So I get my hearing aids from the Veterans Administration and get my drugs, nothing else. And I have my own medical care and own insurance and so on, but I've done that for over 25 years. I have had the most, and all this controversy about the VA, and I'm sure there are bad things that have to happen, but I'm going to tell you as a patient, I can tell you right now, I have never seen any group of people more dedicated and more efficient. I've never had a problem in all those years. And, in fact, I have an appointment right now, July 31st, for a new set of hearing aids. I've had these for a good long time, and they called and said, you're due for a new set of hearing aids. And I just want to get that in because this is what this thing is all about. You know, we can talk about what we did in the past, and that's right. And you served your country, and I thank you for your service. You were in the Vietnam War, which was a toughie. But I can tell you that this Fisher House, which is going to be 16,000 square feet with 16 apartments in it, and it serves the same kind of a function as Ronald McDonald House does for children in conjunction here in Ann Arbor with the Mount Hospital. For patients that come in for extended treatment, they don't require hospitalization, a place to stay, and they're financially challenged. Or they're here for some tough treatment, they're in the hospital, and their families are here. Their wife or families are here, and they're challenged with regard to resources, can't afford a motel. That's what this is all about, where families and patients can stay if there's an extended period where they need this. And there are a bunch of them across the United States, and some states have many, and Michigan's not blessed with any. And that's why the Rotary Club of Ann Arbor took this on as a particular project, and I happen to be a member of the Rotary Club here, and think this is not only worthwhile, but I think it's something that's very much needed and a good way to expend your energies and use your talent to get this built. And that's why Kate is here, and that's why the others on the committee are doing this, and that's why people give to this. So we're trying to raise $4.5 million, $5 million, really $3.5 million for the building itself, then $1.5 million to take care of the beginning care for some of these people, the expenses of caring for the families when they're there. And Kate here has been instrumental in this, and we've got over $1 million raised already. And with all of you listening out there, if you want to be a part of this, you sure can be. And
absolutely. You just go to FisherHouseMichigan.org and click on the donate button right now.
You know that every guy or gal that signs up to go out and defend this country, defend the things that we hold dear that are in that Declaration of Independence, equal opportunity, and the pursuit of happiness and so on. every person that does that are really signing a blank check. And in that money line, it says, everything I have up to and including my life. That's the pledge. And that's the kind of people we're looking forward to helping.
That's very true. And, you know, one of the things that we always say on Veterans Radio, and this is when I send out email that says at the bottom of it, it says, the willingness with which our young people are likely to serve in any war, no matter how justified, shall be directly proportional to how they perceive veterans of earlier wars were treated and appreciated by our nation. And that is signed by a good friend of mine, George Washington. And I think
it's a wonderful quote.
And I think that that's what we're doing. That's what you're doing. And Kate, I know that once the Fisher House is built, tell our audience what happens to it.
Once the construction is complete, our community foundation, Fisher House Michigan, and the National Fisher House Foundation, we hand the keys over to the VA. The VA is responsible for the operation and the maintenance of the facility. But our community foundation sticks around to support the house manager, to support the families, you know, to fill in the gaps that the VA wouldn't necessarily provide, making sure the refrigerator is filled. A Fisher House is not just lodging. If that's all we needed, we'd build a hotel and that'd be the end of it.
Right.
But we're creating a place where families can come together and have a support network. You know, the military family is different from our civilian families, and we understand things a little bit differently. And when you get a bunch of military families together who have family members in inpatient care at the VA, they can talk about what that means and how hard it is, and they support each other.
I think I'm talking about almost like an instant support group.
Yes, sir.
That would be there of 16 different families that are going through different, you know, whatever their issues happen to be. And I agree with you, Art, about the treatment that at least that I have received at the VA hospital here in Ann Arbor. We're very fortunate, I think, to have a dedicated staff.
Excellent.
That is out there. And you know, mainly, you know, one of the reasons that we are fortunate is that half, the, you know, the doctors go back and forth between the VA and the University of Michigan Medical Center. So we are getting excellent care. And as a matter of fact, I go back in November to get my upgraded hearing aid. So you'll have to tell me what's going on.
Yep. Ann Arbor is a good place to be sick.
It is.
Not that you want to be, but it's a great place to be sick.
It is a great place to be sick. So you had a souvenir that you got after World War II that I'd like you to kind of describe to our audience.
Well,
Kate's going to grab it for you.
I went on the Honor Flight Michigan about 3 or 4 years ago to Washington, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. They get out in the morning and fly out there, mm-hmm. and no expense. It's no cost to the veteran. And on that flight with a plane load of guys, I met my contemporaries, a bunch of them from World War II, and one of them let them in wheelchairs and so on, but this guy was on a cane, a good guy and well-spoken, and he had this cane with an eagle for a head, yeah. and his picture on it, and really a summary of his career, a picture when he was in the service, and a picture afterwards, his ribbons, his rank, and so on. I said, "Where'd you get that?" He said, "Well, the Michigan woodcarvers will carve one of this for a veteran that's been in combat." And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to have one." So I got he told me how to get the application. I sent it in. And they check, they get your service record. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know the ribbons I was entitled to. And they did. They put on these ribbons down there. And,
wow, I didn't know I did that, right?
Yeah, they're right here on the shaft. And I got it. And it's just a beautiful job of carving. And you don't know who does it. It mm-hmm. turned out the man that did mine was from Monroe, Michigan, or someplace like that, down around Monroe. And it's just a beautiful job. And I think the Michigan wood carvers deserve a little recognition for this. It's a wonderful keepsake, and it's just
I think
nice.
I think it's excellent. I can't wait to contact him. I was looking at it. I hope I've got the right website here. It says Michigan Wood Carvers Association. To promote the art of wood carving.
You can sure find it out from somebody at Honor Flight because they'll know. I found it out from this guy, I think, and can't remember the details now. It's been 4 or 5 years ago, but I was just amazed when I received it, and I haven't really used it. I've been actually using it for a little while mm-hmm. but I'm going to be off of it now. It's a wonderful reminder.
And, I think so. And it's not that you need a conversation starter, but that certainly would work, I think.
No, I need a conversation ender.
Ender? Well, we've got it. Well, we are running up again. We have about 4 minutes to go. So I want to thank you both for coming on to Veterans Radio, and I appreciate it. I love meeting people like you because, unfortunately, my dad died when I was 15, so I didn't get the chance. So this is kind of, I get to hear the stories of maybe some of the things that he might have
gone
through.
Where was he?
He was in the Pacific in the Coast Guard.
Oh, boy. Tough place.
Well, he ended up, the quick story is he ended up in the Coast Guard, taken over by the Navy, and he ended up at Iwo Jima in Okinawa.
Wow.
And, you know, he was 40 years old when he went in, so I do miss out on that. But you had another career after that. So we got about 3 minutes that you could tell some stories about the NFL if you'd like to.
I came into the NFL. I worked high school, college basketball and football, and through some breaks I won't go through now, I happened to end up almost by accident in the National Football League. And I'd always been a Chicago Bear fan, and I'd always wanted to see a Bear-Packer game. And I still get goosebumps when I tell it. We used to get our assignments at that time by airmail. I opened up my first assignment. It was Chicago at Green Bay, September 1964. And I walked on the field that sunshiny, cool day, and I looked around that stadium, and I thought, I'm going to meet Vincent Thomas Lombardi, the coach of the Packers, and George Halas, the coach of the Bears and founder of the NFL when he was coach of the Decatur Staleys in Illinois. And I walked, I said to Norm Schachter, the referee, I said, "What do I do?" He says, "Walk up to the coach, introduce yourself." So I walked up to Halas and said, "Coach Halas, Art Holst, the line judge." The Babs, the back judge at that time, the back judge. Oh, nice to meet you, host. We've heard about you. You're doing a great job. And well, I got this snow job from him about how great it was going to be and how good I was. And then he said, now just one thing today. He said, they got these two ends. Turned out to be Ron Kramer, who I later knew, of course, from the Lions, but he was with the Packers then. Kramer's an 85 McGee, Max McGee. And he said, they're big guys, and they push my little defensive backs around. And he said, that's offensive pass interference. I want you to call them. I said, yeah, we'll watch everything, Coach. I said, I'm not going to say another word to you today, and he didn't. And then I walked up to Lombardi. I said, Coach Lombardi, Art Holst. The Lions said, now this is our back judge. I said, and this guy is the most tightly wound man I ever met. I walked up to him, and I said, Coach Lombardi, Art Holst. Yeah, yeah, what do you want? What do you want? I said, give you the time and get your captains. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What is it? I said, well, it's 12:01. We're going to kick off 1:01, 15-minute half. I'll give you a 5-minute warning. All right, thanks. What else? I said, who are your captains? Yeah, where are the captains? I can't remember. Who are the captains, Phil? I knew who they were, but I didn't want to tell them. Yeah, 87 Davis and 76 Goransky. Yeah, yeah. I said, he said, anything else? I said, nope. He said, thanks. Walked away. He was really wound up tight, but he was a great football coach. And I was telling her, he was a great disciplinarian. Mm-hmm. Those guys and that team, suits, ties, no beards, no long hair, no nothing. One guy said something about he wanted to do it. He said, that's all right. You can do it for somebody else. Your trains, planes, and buses leaving all the time. But that's if you're going to play for here, you do it my way.
Well, thank you for that. I'm sorry we don't have any more time. We got about 10 seconds. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Art, very much. Fisherhouse.org. Go donate. Tune in next week here on Veterans Radio. Until then, you are dismissed.
Thank you.